to characterize the waste that ends up out there, it's a massive carpet of gelatinous goo.
The EPA fines Trident Seafoods for hundreds of Clean Water Act violations. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Wednesday, September 28th. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, a financial critique of the governor's oil tax plan.
It is very likely that this will put downward pressure on our credit rating. The loss of our credit rating will have a severe impact all across Alaska.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by the law firm of Landy Bennett Blumstein, attorneys who know the people, businesses, tribes, and communities of Alaska. Landy Bennett Blumstein, online at lbblawyers.com. And by
Alyeska Pipeline Service Company, committed to safety, operating the Trans-Alaska Pipeline with over 700 employees.
Trident Seafoods is agreeing to pay the federal government $2.5 million to settle Clean Water Act violations at its Alaska processing facilities. The Seattle-based company will also spend tens of millions to upgrade facilities and clean up the seafloor. The Environmental Protection Agency is calling the agreement a game changer for environmental practices in the industry in Alaska. APRN's Annie Feit reports.
Picture a seafood waste pile in Akatan Harbor that stretches for 50 acres. It's the equivalent of 38 football fields, and in some spots, it's 20 feet thick. But what exactly is it?
It's a massive carpet of gelatinous goo.
That's Tara Martich with the Environmental Protection Agency's Compliance Office. The agency says the piles have created dead zones on the ocean floor. Trident Seafoods will now have to study its fish waste piles at Akatan and other processing plants across the state and figure out ways to clean them up. According to the agreement, the company racked up 480 Clean Water Act violations at 14 of its onshore and offshore processing facilities in Alaska between 2005 and 2010. Trident characterizes the violations as mostly monitoring and reporting errors. Joe Plesha is the company's chief legal officer. He says top officials at Trident didn't know the violations were taking place.
The management did not. The person who was involved in filling out these forms claimed not to understand that they weren't filled out correctly. They do require a great deal of attention to detail and a great deal of time.
But the EPA says Trident is a repeat offender when it comes to Clean Water Act violations in Alaska. Ed Kowalski is director of compliance and enforcement at the agency.
So they were well aware of those requirements and had been reminded of them. And even these violations, before we actually brought the formal enforcement action, they had received a number of warnings and notices from us.
He says the company has logged 6 previous enforcement actions for similar violations, but he thinks this action may be a game changer for the company and the industry in Alaska, in part because Trident is agreeing to build a new fish meal plant in Naknek that will be able to handle 30 million pounds of seafood waste each year from Trident and other companies.
I do hope that this is an opportunity to do more in terms of encouraging the seafood processing industry to take advantage of those alternative ways of keeping the waste out of the water. And we will continue working down that path toward that goal, and we'll just have to see how it goes.
Trident says the new plant will be unique. Joe Plesha says the company wants to set the industry standard for environmental compliance, and the Naknek plant will help it do that.
We're making a meal out of salmon waste, which is it's just typically not done because of the shortness of the season. And so it's new, and I think we hope to prove that it's economically viable.
Trident is working on another innovative project at its Akatan plant. The company is developing technology to capture tiny particles of fish protein that currently escape into the ocean after passing through a 0.5-millimeter screen. The company operates 18 processing facilities in Alaska. In Anchorage, I'm Annie Feit.
A legislative agency today reports that the state's credit status will be at risk if the oil tax reductions proposed by the governor become law. APRN's Dave Donaldson reports.
One of the more controversial issues expected during next year's legislature is a bill introduced by Governor Parnell that would reduce oil taxes from the current levels by as much as $2 billion a year, depending on oil market prices. Anchorage Democrat Bill Willikowski, the chairman of the Senate's State Affairs Committee, says the nonpartisan Legislative Research Service found that the substantial decrease in revenue that would follow the tax cut could be seen by credit agencies as a negative factor.
These are the governor's numbers, and the governor's numbers show that we will be losing billions of dollars. The governor's numbers show that within the next decade, the state will be broke. According to this nonpartisan legislative research report, the research they've done, it is very likely that this will put downward pressure on our credit rating. The loss of our credit rating will have a severe impact all across Alaska.
As an example, Willikowski says that by lowering the credit rating by one level, from AAA to AA+, the price for the Susitna Hydroelectric Project alone would increase by more than $300 million in higher interest on the bonds for the project. He says Alaska needs the revenue to build infrastructure projects and to protect jobs that Alaskans already have.
$2 billion into the Alaskan economy every year creates thousands and thousands of jobs all across the state. So you take that money out of the capital budget, which is going to happen if you pass the governor's bill, you're talking about losing probably thousands of jobs all across Alaska.
Economist Greg Erickson is editor-at-large for the Alaska Budget Report, which reported in February on the connection between the governor's tax cut and the state's credit standing. He's not ready to project the effects of credit ratings on job growth. He says the Parnell administration recognized that the reason for high credit ratings was the savings and income from the current oil tax regime. However, in the budget report's story in February, the administration denied any possible negative effects of a lower income.
But, of course, their denial, which they issued in an email to me, was totally devoid of any backup at all. They just said it. And it's been remarkable how little analysis the administration did to support its proposed policy. And it's not surprising, given the lack of analysis, that they haven't made much progress with it.
The Parnell administration did not reply to requests for a response to the legislative research report or to Willikowski's comments. I'm Dave Donaldson in Juneau.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, a sailor attempting to circle the Americas.
This is like a deadly game of Frogger, you know, and I'm just dodging these storms, trying not to get run over.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by BP, supporting public broadcasting in Alaska.
Whether visiting Barrow or attending business in Juneau, APRN goes with listeners wherever they roam. Your company's message can span across Alaska on 26 stations. Find out how by calling 907-550-8437.
After 7 months of uncertainty, the head of the Denali Commission says a long-awaited answer about whether the commission would need to return $15 million has been settled. Joel Nehemiah is the federal co-chair of the commission. He's been waiting for months for clarity from both the Office of Management and Budget, OMB, and the Government Accountability Office, GAO, on how and if $15 million in carryover funds the commission had on its books had to be returned. Nehemiah says the agency has returned all of the money.
So of the money we gave back, there wasn't any specific projects that were ongoing that were harmed. There weren't any specific projects that were about to start that were harmed. It's basically lost opportunity. So I would say what it really turns out to mean is some projects may have started in FY12, but more likely FY13 aren't going to happen, $15 million worth.
He says within 48 hours of receiving the FY11 money last week, all funds were obligated and $15 million was carved out from various pots and returned. The issue arose last year when congressional staffers told Nehemiah it didn't look good for the commission to carry over funds from year to year. It appeared the agency didn't need the money, even though the commission operates with what is known as no-year money, which means carryover should be fine. But Nehemiah heeded the warning, dutifully obligating funds to future projects, then was told in February Congress wanted the money returned. Nehemiah says he's making changes in how money is doled out and says if passed, In the past, if projects were languishing, commission members would politely ask the grantee if they could help.
I think those days are over. I think we're going to have to start managing those kind of funds, and if grantees are languishing or their projects are languishing because maybe they don't, you know, they thought they had site control and now they don't, they didn't get their permits, there's some sort of, maybe they didn't get their funding, or for whatever reason that the projects aren't moving forward, if we're going to have to put them on notice, and if they continue not making forward progress, we're going to have to take those funds and put them back out onto other projects.
He says this will be one of the biggest changes going forward. He says he'll also insist on more frequent billing from grantees rather than waiting for one final bill, and they will only carry over required base amounts. Kathy Wasserman is the executive director of the Alaska Municipal League, the organization that advocates for municipalities throughout the state. Wasserman is also a commissioner on the Denali Commission. She says although the commission did nothing wrong, she's concerned that some congressional members will see the rescission as a black mark.
I'm sure it doesn't enhance things, but, and things are already looking a little wobbly. I know all three in the delegation have been working hard to reauthorize the commission, and I'm sure this is just one more kind of mark that makes their job a little more difficult.
Wearing her AML hat, Wasserman says she's worried about how small communities will be able to secure funds for big ticket items in the future.
If you have a huge need in your community and you can't get an earmark and you can't get a loan and you can't sell bonds, how are you going to get some of those things purchased? I mean, you can save money till the cows come home, but it's just not going to happen. So this probably will put a lot of communities back a bit by not enabling them to get some of their infrastructure up where they can just provide basic services.
The commission's Niemeyer says the types of projects that will be delayed are fuel system upgrades and waterfront improvements. He is optimistic, however, that the commission is on firm financial ground for future work and new collaborations.
It means that we'll be doing a lot more collaboration with local communities, with regional partners, and with our state and federal agencies to find out how can we leverage our funds to better use. And I think my team is up for that, and I think our program partners are, you know, enthusiastic about that, and I think the next couple of years hopefully won't be as painful as this one was.
Niemeyer says he anticipates FY12 money will be consistent with current year funds. Traveling through the Northwest Passage is challenging for any sailor, but Matt Rutherford has decided to take his trip farther than that by continuing on to circle the Americas. KUCB's Alexandra Gutierrez has the story.
It's been over 100 days since Matt Rutherford walked on dry land, and with any luck, it'll be another 200 before he actually gets to. The 30-year-old Marylander is in the process of sailing around the North and South American continents. If he makes it, he'll be the first person to do the 23,000-mile trip alone and without stopping. He chose Annapolis as his starting point.
From there, you head north, up past Newfoundland, through the Labrador Sea, the Davis Straits, Baffin Bay. You turn west, you go through the Northwest Passage, then you go over the north coast of Alaska, down the west coast of Alaska, through the Pacific.
He'll round Cape Horn in South America, and then he'll make his way north back to Maryland. Right now, Rutherford is in Alaska waters. The weather's been rough, and some of his gear got busted up while traveling through the Arctic. In order to meet the International Sailing Federation standards, he can't stop in a port to get new equipment if he wants to set a record. But he can have other boats meet him for resupply trips. In Unalaska Bay, Jeff Hancock with Aleutian Adventure Sports ferries over a new watermaker, some stove fuel, and a tiller pilot. Since Rutherford's diet is mostly made up of dehydrated food, Hancock brings him plenty of snacks as well.
Chips, candy bars, M&Ms, cookies, things like that. He can't, you know, fresh food won't keep very long, so I only got him a small amount of that type of thing, a little bit of fresh produce. He requested one steak, which I think he's going to probably eat tonight.
When they connect, Hancock also surprises him with a hot pizza and cold beer, a combination that Rutherford hasn't had since he left home.
It's almost so good and so strange that you can't even wrap your mind around it. You know, it's like you're drinking beer and it's great to be drinking a beer, but it's so great to be drinking a beer that it's almost like you're not drinking a beer.
It's the little things like that that he misses the most.
You miss basic stuff. You miss basic conversations you have with people. You know, the conversation you have in the morning over a cup of coffee, glass of wine in the evening. You miss hot showers. I miss hot showers a lot. I haven't had a shower in forever. Although you can stand naked in the rain, but it's pretty cold up here.
A lack of showers doesn't mean that he's been dry. If anything, he's been in a constant state of wetness for weeks.
You know, you just get kind of worn down over time because you're cold and wet and mold grows everywhere. I got mold in my books, I got mold in my clothes, I got mold in my ears.
The boat he's using isn't particularly special, and it's hard to imagine it outside of the Chesapeake Bay, let alone sailing through the icy Northwest Passage or stormy Bering Sea. It's a 27-foot Alban Vega that was built in the 1970s, and it wouldn't look out of place in most marinas. The cabin is about the size of a college dorm room, and the deck could probably be mistaken for a jacuzzi tub if it were full of water, which it often is with the weather that he's seen.
This is like a deadly game of Frogger, you know, and I'm just dodging these storms, trying not to get run over. But since I'm really too slow to dodge a storm, it comes down to a bit of a luck. And my luck hasn't been that great, but then again, I'm not on the bottom of the ocean, so I guess my luck is still holding up somewhat.
But even though it's not an easy trip, Rutherford still gets plenty of joy from it, and he says that the freedom that he feels while sailing doesn't compare to much else in life.
I don't gotta worry about bills, I ain't gotta worry about nothing. I ain't gotta go to work. But then again, it's a lot of work to be out in the ocean alone, so I mean, it goes both ways. But I got no boss, my boss is Poseidon.
Plus, after getting this far, it would be hard to justify blowing the record for just one night in town. Rutherford says that it's also important for him to complete the voyage so he can raise money for Chesapeake Regional Accessible Boating, or CRAB, which aims to get disabled and disadvantaged Marylanders sailing. Rutherford has worked as a volunteer with the nonprofit, and they actually provided the sailboat for the journey. Getting the boat back to them in one piece has been a big motivator.
You know, it's sheer determination that's going to get me through this trip, and it's got me this far. There is no failure. There is no, well, I might fail, but I hope not. But there is no other option.
Rutherford is scheduled to complete the trip by May. You can follow his journey at his website, solotheamericas.org. In Unalaska, I'm Alexander Gutierrez.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Wells Fargo, providing Alaskans steps to help reach their financial goals. Wells Fargo Bank, N.A. Solstice Advertising, bringing creativity to Alaska businesses and nonprofits. From research and strategy to print, web, and broadcast production. Solstice Advertising, an agency for brands that want to shine. And by the Pebble Partnership, developing a comprehensive mine plan that meets Alaska's regulatory requirements while supporting sustainable fisheries in Southwest Alaska. PebblePartnership.com.
On the Kenai Peninsula, the race for borough mayor is a crowded one this year, with a total of 6 candidates vying for the job. KBBI's Aaron Selbig joins us on the phone from Homer to discuss the race. Hi, Aaron.
Hi, Lori.
So give us a quick rundown on all 6 candidates.
Well, you've got 2 former borough mayors, Mike Navarre from Kenai, who held the job from 96 to 99, and then Dale Bagley from Soldotna, who beat Navarre in 99 and held 2 terms through 2005. You've got longtime borough assembly member Gary Superman from Nikiski. You've got Fred Sturman from Soldotna, who is a well-known presence at borough assembly meetings, and he's likely the favorite candidate of the conservative group Alliance for Concerned Taxpayers. There's Debbie Brown from Kasilof, a former assembly and school board member. And then the relative unknown in the race is Tim O'Brien. He's a longtime resident of Nikiski and a retired construction worker.
So that list doesn't include the current Kenai Peninsula borough mayor, Dave Carey. Why not?
Well, after one term in office, Mayor Carey decided not to run for re-election, which, as you know, Laurie, is almost unheard of in politics. He put the decision off for a long time. He announced in June that he would not be running for re-election. He told us that it would be unfair to the voters for him to run a re-election campaign while still in office. My personal impression over the last 3 years is that the job kind of wore on Dave Carey, who is by nature a pretty upbeat guy. He told us, and I quote, "When you get into the shark tank and you swim with the sharks, You either become one of them or you get eaten. And he has a point. Borough politics here can get pretty nasty. It's too bad for those of us who attend a lot of borough meetings and functions because Mayor Carey had a habit of bringing one of those huge containers of Red Vines licorice to all the meetings, and he would pass it out to everybody, and I personally am going to miss that.
I can see why. Is there a front runner in the race?
Well, as far as I know, there hasn't been any official polling. Anecdotally, a lot of folks, at least on the southern part of the Kenai Peninsula, are foreseeing a tight race between the two former mayors, Dale Begley and Mike Navarre. Both of them have run very active campaigns, they have a lot of signs, they've raised a lot of money, and they both have high-profile supporters.
So, Aaron, what happens if the race is close?
Well, then we'll be looking at a runoff election. By law, a runoff election is required if none of the candidates reaches a 50% threshold, and I think with six candidates, that's honestly not very likely. It wouldn't be an instant runoff, however. There would be a separate runoff election between the two candidates who received the most votes.
All right. Well, thanks for helping us understand the mechanics of the race that you've got going on down there, Aaron.
Thank you. I appreciate it, Lori. Election Day, October 4th, next Tuesday.
Member station KBBI's Aaron Selbig talking to us from Homer. This week, the power purchase agreement between Chugach Electric Association and the Fire Island Wind Project has come before the Regulatory Commission of Alaska for its needed approval. But if yesterday's opening statements are any indication, the agreement is facing some strong headwinds. KSKA's Len Anderson reports.
Chugach Electric finds itself outnumbered by naysayers before the Regulatory Commission of Alaska. Its chief opponents are Anchorage's Municipal Light and Power and the Alaska Department of Law. Chugach and Fire Island Wind's power purchase agreement needs RCA approval to proceed with construction. And it needs that blessing quickly. Todd Glass, an attorney representing Chugach Electric, said the utility hoped that RCA could decide by October 10th. At risk, Glass continued, was a $19 million federal grant to Fire Island Wind.
This grant in lieu of tax credits is a fleeting thing that if the developer does not start construction this year and place orders for long lead time items and otherwise invest, they will not have the opportunity to obtain this grant.
Although the $65 million 11-turbine wind farm project developed by Cook Inlet Region Incorporated via its Fire Island subsidiary has been in the works for some time, it wasn't until this summer that Chugach Electric Association agreed to a power purchase agreement. The PPA covers 25 years. That translates as electric power for about 6,000 Anchorage homes per year. Chugach says that would result in slightly higher consumer rates during the first 10 years, but produce savings as natural gas prices rise in the final 15 years. Natural gas is the primary source for electricity production in south-central Alaska. Chugach estimates it will save ratepayers about $3 million over 25 years. Assistant Attorney General Steve DeVries works with the Regulatory Affairs and Public Advocacy Division. He says Chugach's analysis requires a more thorough review.
The quick review in this docket has certainly hamstrung our review.
DeVries questioned assumptions underlying the agreement, such as interconnection construction costs, intermittent power source costs, along with future natural gas price estimates and carbon credits. He said the commission needs to ask itself two questions concerning any possible Chugach errors.
How much? And the second question to ask yourself and look for an answer is, who pays? Because neither of those issues has been addressed, because ultimately, when you answer those questions, I assume the answer will be Chugach's ratepayers. It will wind up trickling its way down into a cost of service that Chugach's ratepayers will be asked to shoulder.
DeVries also maintains the cost-benefits analysis did not get sufficient attention. Dean Thompson, MLNP's attorney, mentioned similar concerns with the added note that MLNP was seeking to protect its ratepayers from any increased costs that might arise from an intermittent power source like wind. Chugach's Glass said this power purchase agreement from an independent source was a new realm for the commission. As such, it requires the RCA to approach its decision in a new manner.
It's whether or not Chugach, in making the decision and entering into this contract, was justified and reasonable, just and reasonable. It is not, for instance, whose view of the future of carbon value is most correct. It is not a battle of whose view of the natural gas future prices is most correct.
Glass also said Fire Island Wind Incorporated will cover any construction cost overruns, and the power provider agreement calls for the wind farm operators to absorb any costs incurred from winds too light to meet daily power commitments. The RCA hearing continues to Friday. In Anchorage, this is Len Anderson.
Fairbanks Borough schools are facing a budget challenge. That was one of the messages from North Star Borough District Superintendent Pete Lewis in a State of the Schools address to the Fairbanks Chamber of Commerce yesterday. Lewis described the $206 million operating budget as unsustainable.
Our revenues will not match our expenditures. We are not sustainable. We're going to have to make some difficult decisions.
Lewis said those decisions will be made by the school board and administration with input from the public. He attributes the budget problem to rising costs and a reliance this year on one-time funds.
We had one-time funding in terms of jobs bill money, approximately $2.1 million. $23.5 million came to the state, and our portion of that was $2.1 million. And then there was also energy money that came from the legislature in terms of $20 million. And again, our portion of that was, ironically, $2.1 million. And so, there's $4.2 million in one-time money right there.
Lewis says the district needs to work away from up and down year-to-year budgeting. He says a series of public budget forums will be held around the district next month to identify funding priorities. And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org. You can follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Alexandra Gutierrez in Unalaska, Aaron Selbig in Homer, Len Anderson in Anchorage, and Dan Bross in Fairbanks. APRN's Dave Donaldson reported from Juneau. Our editor and producer is Annie Fite. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. And I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
Northern Air Cargo. For over 54 years, Alaskans have entrusted Northern Air Cargo to transport their freight. Thank you, Alaska, for the opportunity to serve you for decades to come. The Federal Aviation Administration sets standards for the operation of aircraft in airports and provides services to the flying public. Passengers are influential in making flying safer in Alaska, so when passengers know their rights and responsibilities, aviation is safer for everyone. There's more information online at faa.gov/go/flyalaska or toll-free at 1-866-357-4704. This message sponsored by the FAA.
You can find APRN headlines and more online at alaskapublic.org. There you'll discover local and worldwide news, upcoming events, and statewide community conversation. alaskapublic.org, connecting you to Alaska one story at a time.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.